In the context of higher education, student body diversity is a compelling state interest that can justify the narrowly tailored use of race in admissions.
Almost 20 years ago, with that announcement by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, the Supreme Court confirmed a precedent for how affirmative action can be applied in the context of higher education admissions. But with a new court, a new test. Yesterday, the Supreme Court heard two cases tackling affirmative action in higher education, one involving Harvard, the other the University of North Carolina.
UNC claims license to use race in perpetuity, and the district court held that Grutter allows this. Racial classifications are wrong, and this court should overrule Grutter.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and today, on Point, we'll talk about the future of affirmative action in higher education and what could happen if it's struck down. Joining us now is Michelle Adams. She's a professor at the University of Michigan Law School. Her research centers on race discrimination, school desegregation, and affirmative action, among other things. Professor Adams, welcome to On Point.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much, Kimberly.
So you've listened to yesterday's oral arguments, all 5 hours of it.
I have to tell you, I tried. It was a marathon session, so I listened to most of it.
It really, really was. So what was your major takeaway based on what the justices asked and what the attorneys answered?
Well, a couple thoughts about that. I mean, I think the major takeaway is one that's not going to be exactly new to anyone who's taking a look at the papers. I do think it's highly likely that the court's going to overturn Grutter versus Bollinger, which was decided in 2003, which had allowed universities to use race as a factor in determining who would be admitted to the class. So my first takeaway is that I think it's highly likely that's going to occur. And we can talk a little bit more about that. And then I have a couple other sort of thoughts about the oral argument.
So let's just back up a little bit. We heard that sound from Justice O'Connor sort of restating the standard in Grutter, one that had been established before that in Bakke, that the compelling interest here of the schools that they could permissibly, at least up until this point, consider race among other factors, is for diversity of the student body. And I think it's important to focus on that because a lot of other things that people may think about when it comes to considering race in admissions, whether it's to address past racism in society, current racism in society, make people more prepared for the professional world and dealing with other people. None of those things are factors that this court is considering or that schools can consider. It's really very limited, right?
Well, that's really, I love the question that you just asked because it allows us to kind of go back in time and set the stage for what folks were listening to yesterday and give us a sense of sort of where we're going to go. So let's go back a little bit to the mid-1970s in the Bakke case, which many of our listeners may have heard about. And in that case, we were dealing with University of California, Davis admissions program. They had 100 seats for their medical school, and they set aside 16 of those 100 seats for underrepresented minority group members. And this is challenged by Alan Bakke, who's a white applicant who applied over a couple of different admission cycles and was not admitted to the medical school. And we get to the Supreme Court, and there's a couple of different arguments there. One is that the use of the racial classification scheme in UCal Davis's admissions program violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And then another argument, which also came up yesterday in the UNC and Harvard case, having to do with a federal statute, Title VI. And basically what the federal statute says is that it's illegal to discriminate on the basis of race in entities receiving federal funding. So both of these claims go up to the Supreme Court in the mid-1970s. And essentially what the court does is it strikes down the University of California at Davis's affirmative action plan. But it does it in a very interesting way, with the court sort of split between is it going to be having to do with is it going to be having to do with the federal statute, that it violated the federal statute, that it violated the Constitution? And you have a bit of a split decision on that. But the key thing that comes out of the Bakke Davis case is Justice Powell. And that's what I want to focus on now, because I think that goes back to the initial question that you asked. Mm-hmm. And what Justice Powell says is, well, there's a lot of different rationales that are being given for this affirmative action plan. One of them is that we want to have more doctors who go and serve underserved communities. Another is that we want to remedy societal discrimination. Another is that we want to have more folks of color in the medical profession. And then the last one was this idea of viewpoint diversity. And what Justice Powell does is he says, you know what, those first three, they really aren't good enough justifications for using race in an admissions plan. But this viewpoint diversity idea, that actually has legs. And then what he does is he focuses on a brief that had been submitted by Harvard University, and he kind of muses about the Harvard's plan, which used race as a factor to determine who would get into the school. And so even though the Harvard program wasn't at issue, Justice Powell talks about it approvingly, and it really doesn't have the support of a majority of the court. But what's so interesting is that even though the Davis plan gets struck down, after the Bakke case, schools and universities start using Justice Powell's idea of diversity to justify the use of race in affirmative action plans. And so that helps set the stage for why it was, in your interim question, that there was no discussion of past societal discrimination or identified discrimination or remedial purpose or any of that. We really are focused on this very narrow question of diversity, and we can talk more about that. But that's sort of the setting the stage for why that was sort of the heart and soul of the oral argument yesterday.
And I appreciate that setup because it's important. And I want to turn out to what these programs at Harvard and UNC and elsewhere are doing now. During yesterday's hearing, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson raised concerns about the plaintiff's argument that race has been used as a singular decisive factor for many student admissions.
How is race being used in this process? You keep saying we object to the use of race standing alone. But as I read the record and understand their process, it's never standing alone. That it's in the context of all of the other factors. There are 40 factors about all sorts of things that the admissions office is looking at, and you haven't demonstrated or shown one situation in which all they look at is race and take from that stereotypes and other things.
So how is race being used, according to the schools, in their admissions process?
So now we fast forward to 2003 in the Grutter case. So we're going to give a little background on that, and then I'm going to answer your question, which is to say Justice Powell had mused about the idea of Harvard using race as a factor, and that might be okay. And then we get up to the Supreme Court again in 2003, and we get a challenge to both the undergraduate admissions program and the law school admissions program here at the University of Michigan. And Justice O'Connor, while saying, oh, the undergrad program is no good, that really, you know, you can't have a certain set of bonus points that are set aside, we really like, or we approve of, the plan that was used by the University of Michigan Law School, which used race as a factor among many factors to determine who would be admitted to the law school, right? So there would be a variety of different kinds of diversity that could be brought to the law school. Among them was racial diversity. And the idea is that there was a certain amount of freedom that the universities have in selecting their class. And so if they need, and I think this came up yesterday, if they need more oboe players, or if they want more geographical diversity, Justice Powell talked about the farm boy from Idaho, that in sort of making its class sort of like a recipe for a great dish, you want to have all different kinds of elements of that. And race could be one of those. And so I think what Justice Jackson was talking about was the idea that race was never the only factor that the universities were looking at. They were looking at a variety of factors, of which race was one.
And another thing that the Grutter decision was cited was this idea that there is a sunset or a time limit for consideration of race. In that decision in 2003, the Supreme Court wrote that, quote, race-conscious admissions policies must be limited in time, and that it, quote, expects that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interest approved today. During yesterday's oral arguments, Chief Justice John Roberts questioned if UNC's current stance would ever allow that to happen.
I don't see how you can say that the program will ever end. Your position is that race matters because it's necessary for diversity, which is necessary for the sort of education you want. it's not going to stop mattering at some particular point. You're always going to have to look at race because you say race matters to give us the necessary diversity.
So that 25-year, that statement about 25 years in Grutter, that was 19 years ago. What do you think of the point that the Chief Justice is making that race is always going to matter?
Well, so it's very interesting. So two things about that. Number one, there's a lot of debate about sort of what status that particular paragraph in Grutter actually had, right? So a lot of folks think it's what lawyers call dicta, which is it was not necessarily to the holding, in which case it wasn't really something that has kind of a strong precedential effect. And I think you heard a lot of discussion going back and forth yesterday during the oral arguments about sort of how do we think about Justice O'Connor's discussion of this 25-year frame. In teaching that case, I've always taken the position that was sort of more aspirational on her behalf as opposed to something that was a hard and fast rule. So one of the questions that the court's trying to deal with is sort of how to handle that 25-year period. If in fact it's aspirational, then we aren't bound by it. And even if we are, we're a little bit early, right? We should be looking at sort of 2028 or something along those lines. I do think, though, that this other question of sort of how long are we going to need race goes back to a point that I've been making earlier, and it goes back, takes us back to Bakke and Justice Powell. Because once you're in a frame or you're in a slot talking about the use of race for diversity purposes, you're no longer talking about sort of what happened in the past and the past's impact on the present. You're no longer talking about systemic racism. You're no longer talking about slavery. You're no longer talking about Jim Crow. You're no longer talking about the fact that our schools are segregated and continue to be so. And so the entire discussion had a kind of artificial air to it yesterday, where we were talking about how long will we need to use race, when the reality is that those lingering effects of past discrimination and present discrimination are with us today, and it's just something that.
So, Michelle, I'm going to pause you there, and we'll come back after the break. We're talking about the Supreme Court and affirmative action. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Today, we're discussing the future of affirmative action and what could happen if Grutter v. Bollinger is overturned. We're joined by Michelle Adams. She's a professor at the University of Michigan Law School. And Michelle, I want to go back to the point that you were making at the end of the last segment, which includes what the interest, we talked about the compelling interest that schools must show under the court's precedent, but maybe talk a little bit more about what you think the compelling interest should be and whether that's changed. During oral arguments yesterday, Justice Clarence Thomas repeatedly asked whether diversity actually achieves an educational benefit.
I'd like you to give us a specific definition of diversity in the context of the University of North Carolina. And I'd also like you to give us a clear idea of exactly what the educational benefits of diversity at the University of North Carolina would be.
So, Michelle, I want you to talk about that, the benefits of having diversity within the classroom, the current compelling interest, the only one that's been approved by the Supreme Court. What benefit does that actually give students, and which students does it benefit?
Well, I mean, you know, the answer, I think, has to be from the oralist and consistent with Supreme Court precedent, is that we just go back to what Justice O'Connor talked about in the Grutter case, right? So she outlined several benefits of racial diversity in an academic setting. The first was the one that I think Justice Powell had gotten at. He identified that benefit as viewpoint diversity, which is that in a classroom you'd have an exchange of viewpoints, and that it would enhance the educational experience for everyone, right? All students, right? Not just students of color, but white students and everyone who's in the university, right? But what's really interesting about what Justice O'Connor does in Grutter is she goes so far beyond that, right? So it's really a kind of diversity plus, if you will. So it's not just this idea of viewpoint diversity. It's about sort of what happens to people when they come together in an environment and engage in a joint enterprise. And there'd been a lot of social science data that suggested that actually broke down stereotypes, that when we come together in an educational context or in a sports context, we learn about our shared humanity, and we recognize that some of the things we might have been told about the other group really aren't true. And so that has an incredibly important sort of societal benefit. But then she didn't stop there. She said, well, we're also, you know, and this was, I think, very interesting, we are now living in a multiracial society. And so having access to diversity and being educated in a multiracial environment prepares students to be able to function in a diverse society. And then finally is this notion of leadership, right? So now we're focusing on these selective institutions, and particularly the University of Michigan Law School. And everyone knows that if you go there and schools like it, that you will have an opportunity to become a leader, a governor, a legislator, a judge, the head of a law firm. And so what she worried about was a sort of political disconnect, that in fact, if our leadership class didn't reflect the sort of general racial makeup of our society, that it might actually create democratic accountability problems. I think she worried about democracy. And so all of this is floating around in Justice O'Connor's Grutter decision. And those are the kinds of benefits that UNC and Harvard are talking about achieving. But again, I just want to make this point very, very clearly. There are so many other conversations that we could have been having about the need for students of color in these institutions, and we weren't having them because of the Bakke case.
Yes, and one of those, and sort of maybe an offshoot of the importance of diversity of within the class itself, it's not just that all of the benefits that you just listed, but when you don't have a critical number of students of color in a class, it can be a burden to them. I've experienced, and I'm sure you've experienced at some point in your education, being one of the only or the only person of color in a class. And there is an intellectual and emotional burden that is put on you as being that representative, right?
Well, I think a couple points about that I think is it's a great question and a great observation, right? So Justice O'Connor talked about this in the Grutter case, and she talked about the importance of a critical mass of students of color so that no individual student of color would feel like they were a spokesperson for their race. And so there had to be enough folks in a classroom, in an educational environment to break that down, but also for other students to recognize that there's not one, you know, Black folks don't all think one thing, that there's a variety and diversity of viewpoints among different racial groups, right? And so that I think was just a really important part. And, you know, that's something that Justice Kennedy in the Fisher cases, just a couple of years later, was also concerned about, the idea of isolation and individuals being a spokesperson for their race. And so I think that was also something that was picked up in the Fisher case later on. So there is precedent for all of this stuff. But whether that's going to resonate with the current court is another question.
So I want to ask, one thing I thought about a lot while listening to the argument yesterday is we're talking about Grutter and by extension Bakke, which were decided at different times in our nation, different times in our society. So here we are now in 2022, over the past 2 years, the American society has had a particular reckoning around race in any number of areas. So is the interest and are the factors to consider in diversity in our schools the same as it was 19 years ago or 44 years ago?
Well, I think a couple things. Number one, what you just observed is one of the reasons why someone who sort of tuned into the oral argument yesterday might have just thought, wow, this seems really like bizarre. We've had, you know, the storming of the Capitol January 6th, overt racism being uttered by political figures, sort of everything that's happened in our country in, over the past couple of years. And then you sort of enter into this sort of alternative universe at the Supreme Court where that we're having a conversation that sort of takes race completely outside of that. With respect to the rest of your question having to do is, are things the same? I mean, I think the argument is that we need this more now than ever. More than ever now, when our society is facing these critical junctures having to do with sort of how we view ourselves and our democracy, right? Our very democracy is on the line, that more than ever, we need to have students educated together. And there's one more piece of that, which is that we've moved backwards when it comes to K through 12 desegregation, right? In large part having to do with some of the precedent of the Supreme Court. So it may be this is the first time at college, at university, in graduate programs that students are actually interacting with folks of other races. It's vitally important that we continue to have this.
So, Michelle, I want to pause just for a moment. We've discussed how affirmative action as a policy has helped improve diversity at different levels, including when it comes to higher education. So if Grutter is overturned, what could be the consequences? Let's turn now to California, where in 1996, Proposition 209 was approved to prohibit state governmental institutions from considering race, sex, or ethnicity in public employment, public contracting, and public education.
So we have this great visualization of how UC Berkeley conducted admissions in 1995. Basically, each applicant was placed onto a grid. So along the horizontal axis, you got a score out of 8,000. That was just how well you were academically prepared for college. And then along the Y vertical axis, students were given a social diversity index. So this ranged from A to I, where, for example, an African-American low-income student would be an A. And in California, any international students were categorized as an I.
That's Zachary Bleemer. He's an economist at the Yale School of Management who studies young people and how choices such as where they go to college and what they study have ramifications for the rest of their lives. Professor Bleemer says that until Prop 209 went into effect in 1998, affirmative action as then practiced in the UC system had distinct results. Racial diversity in and of itself had played a significant role.
Some people have in their minds that affirmative action is sort of a light touch policy. There are two applicants that are relatively similar to each other, but one is white and the other is black. And affirmative action lets the black student in instead of the white student. That's not how affirmative action was practiced in California. There were a large number of students who, if they had been white or Asian, would have had essentially no chance of being admitted to schools like Berkeley or UCLA, but were effectively guaranteed or near guaranteed admission if they were black or Hispanics.
So what exactly happened when Prop 209 went into effect?
At the Berkeley and UCLA campuses, the black and Hispanic student populations fell by more than 60%. At the less selective University of California campuses, what you got was this cascade effect where, say, take a school like UC Davis. It's sort of a mid-tier, highly selective public university. UC Davis lost a lot of Black and Hispanic students who were no longer gaining access through affirmative action, but also gained a bunch of Black and Hispanic students who would have previously been enrolling at Berkeley and UCLA, but had lost access to those schools and sort of fell down the rung. And so what you saw is this sort of shift downward. Every Black and Hispanic student was, on average, going to end up enrolling at a school that was a little bit less selective than the school that they had previously had access to.
In his research, Professor Bleemer has found that subsequent impact of Prop 209 had notable educational and labor market ramifications for those students.
They become less likely to earn college degrees, especially among students sort of at the bottom of the academic aptitude distribution. That's in part, I think, because of sort of norms at these universities. You used to go to a university where 80% of students were going to graduate and earn a degree and then take a job. And so those, you know, you yourself became more likely to earn a college degree. If instead you lost access to that university and you went to a school with a 50% graduation rate, with many of your peers dropping out before earning a college degree, these students themselves became less likely to earn college degrees. They became less likely to earn graduate degrees. And if you follow them over the subsequent 15 years, Black and Hispanic young Californians earned about 5% less in the labor market relative to what they would have earned on average if they maintained access to these more selective universities through the prior affirmative action policy.
Based on what happened in California, Professor Bleemer says there are a few lessons we could take away from California's experience if a ban on affirmative action in college admissions went into effect on a national scale.
The first is what I've already said. Black and Hispanic students in California faced pretty substantial negative ramifications in the years after California banned affirmative action. And I think there's good reason to expect that if universities across the country were to ban affirmative action, you would see similar labor market costs over this, you know, the next several decades. I think a second lesson that we can see in California is that, you know, California's affirmative action policy was ended by ballot proposition. It was not a choice made by the universities themselves. The universities maintained a substantial interest in enrolling a student body that, as they said, reflected the high school graduate population of the state. And so the university tried a number of race-neutral admissions policies, you know, policies that weren't explicitly looking at students' race, but nevertheless were aimed at maintaining the level of Black and Hispanic enrollment that they had under the affirmative action regime. Now, the lesson that I think we see from California in that context is that these race-neutral alternative policies had a much smaller impact on the share of Black and Hispanic enrollment than race-based affirmative action. And as a result, we saw real substantial declines in Black and Hispanic enrollment at selective public universities in California that has not meaningfully returned to, you know, any kind of pre-affirmative action level.
That's Zachary Bleemer. He's an assistant professor of economics at the Yale School of Management. And with us today, we continue to talk to Michelle Adams of the University of Michigan Law School. Michelle, there in Michigan, a similar proposition went into place, a voter-approved initiative that banned affirmative action in 2006. What impact have you seen there?
Well, I think it's interesting to take a look at the amicus brief that was submitted by the University of Michigan in these cases. And so, you know, amicus briefs are friend of the court briefs. They're often submitted for different reasons. And Michigan wasn't really trying to re-argue sort of whether Grutter should be upheld or struck down. It was really trying to give the court a benefit of its experience. And so there's a lengthy discussion in Michigan's brief about all the different things it did after the state decided that the universities could no longer use affirmative action, outreach, recruitment, focus on Detroit, additional scholarships, a wide variety of things that they did. And the reality was that what they noticed or what they saw was that when it came to African-American student enrollment, and this is at the University of Michigan now, the flagship schools, was down about 44%, and Native American enrollment was down about 90%. So it's consistent with what the professor found at the University of California.
And we're going to talk a little bit later about what alternatives there might be for schools that want to ensure they have diversity, but if they cannot consider race as a factor. But one point that was repeated yesterday was this idea that race is a zero-sum game when it comes to admissions decisions. Those arguing in favor of the challengers to Harvard's and UNC's program repeatedly said, if you consider race, that necessarily means that somebody who is not a member of a minority group will be disadvantaged in the way that those who are advantaged. Do you think that that holds up based on what we just heard from Professor Bleemer?
Well, this leads to a point that I wanted to make about the oral argument and about Justice Jackson. I mean, I think one of the things she got at, which sounds a little technical, is this idea of standing. And she mentioned it several times during the discussion about UNC. And the question becomes, well, you know, the challengers sort of portrayed this as a zero-sum game. But what she was trying to get at was the idea that the challengers, couldn't really show that but for the application of the affirmative action plan, they would have been admitted to their particular school. So the question becomes, the challengers are talking about a zero-sum game. Standing is the idea of whether you actually have the ability to even sue in a federal court. But what I think she's saying is you can't show that you were actually even harmed by the affirmative action plan. So this whole notion of sort of characterizing it as a zero-sum game is very interesting when you think about it from the perspective of an applicant who can't really make out that they would have been admitted. Now, of course, the response to that is to say, well, you know, we weren't able to compete on an even playing field. But I think that's inconsistent with the idea that it's a zero-sum game if, in fact, the universities are doing what Justice Powell suggested, which is that they're treating everyone as an individual in the admissions process, and they're using race as a factor, then at some point, yeah, maybe that's the factor that tips a particular applicant over, but there could be many other factors that determine whether someone's going to be admitted or not.
Michelle Adams, we'll ask you to hold just for a moment. We're discussing the future of affirmative action in college admissions. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Today, we're discussing the future of affirmative action. And what could happen if the Supreme Court reverses the precedent that allows affirmative action policies in higher education admissions. We're joined by Michelle Adams. She's professor at the University of Michigan Law School. And joining us now is Richard Kallenberg. He's an education policy researcher and writer with expertise in education, civil rights, and equal opportunity. Rick, welcome to On Point.
Oh, wonderful to be here.
So what was your takeaway from yesterday's oral arguments at the court?
Well, my initial takeaway was feeling of hunger pains. I was there in the court itself, and there was 5 hours of argument, a 10-minute break. And so it was an exhausting experience. But let me just say, I think it's clear that those of us who care about racial and economic diversity have to start doing some contingency planning, because I didn't see any evidence that the conservatives on the court, who hold, of course, a 6-3 majority, have much hesitancy in striking down the use of race. You have to recall, this is the court that overturned Roe versus Wade, where the public opinion is strongly against the court. And on this particular issue, you know, according to the Pew Research poll, 74% of Americans don't want race counted as even a minor factor in college admissions. So the court has public opinion on its side, and I think that it's important to start thinking really seriously about alternative ways to get racial and economic diversity.
I want to get to those alternatives in just a moment. First, I want to play just a little bit from the argument. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson offered two hypothetical students to compare affirmative action to legacy admissions.
The first applicant says, "I'm from North Carolina. My family has been in this area for generations, since before the Civil War, and I would like you to know that I will be the fifth generation to graduate from the University of North Carolina. I now have that opportunity to do that, and given my family background, it's important to me that I get to attend this university. I want to honor my family's legacy by going to this school." The second applicant says, "I'm from North Carolina. My family's been in this area for generations, since before the Civil War, but they were slaves and never had a chance to attend this venerable institution. As an African American, I now have that opportunity, and given my family background, it's important to me to attend this university. I want to honor my family legacy by going to this school.
Justice Jackson noted how, according to the non-race conscious admissions rule that Students for Fair Admissions is arguing, the second student story would be too bound to their race for it to be valued by the university. She asked why rejecting the second student on that basis wouldn't be a violation of equal protection rights. So, Richard, I want to talk first about that point. One issue that went that permeated the arguments was, okay, well, if you can't consider race, what else might you not be able to consider? Things like being a descendant of enslaved people might be seen as a sort of code for race, basically the same thing. And maybe that wouldn't be considered too. Just for a moment before we start talking about alternatives, just talk about how classifying what is race can be difficult.
Yeah, I think it was a brilliant question that Justice Jackson posed. I personally don't think we should be using legacy preferences in college admissions. I mean, this is affirmative action for the wealthy. In fact, I wrote a whole book on that topic about how unfair it is to consider legacy. I think in going forward, depending on how the court rules, it's likely that those types of policies that can be justified independently, so giving a preference for socioeconomically disadvantaged students of all races, will be totally fine. But those that look like they're kind of a direct proxy for race are going to face more challenge from the court.
So, Rick, you make the case that one alternative to considering race would be considering class. How is that an alternative, and does it create the same result?
It works about as well to produce racial diversity, and it works much, much better to produce socioeconomic diversity. So at a place like Harvard right now, a majority of the students are students of color, which is a beautiful thing in my view. At the same time, they have 15 times as many rich students as low-income students. So, they've created this multiracial aristocracy of fairly well-off students, which is a whole lot better than all-white aristocracy, but it's still aristocracy. And if we shifted instead to a system of providing, getting rid of the preferences for the wealthy, the legacy preferences, those who, are the children of donors, Harvard has a whole list of those. If we get rid of those and also give a meaningful bump up to socioeconomically disadvantaged students, then you can get a very healthy degree of racial diversity and much more socioeconomic diversity. It's precisely because of our country's terrible history of racial discrimination and ongoing struggles with racial discrimination that Black and Latino students disproportionately benefit from class-based affirmative action and would do quite well under all the modeling that was done in the case suggests that African-American and Latino students will be well represented if Harvard and UNC gets rid of the unfair preferences for the wealthy and gives meaningful consideration to overcoming economic obstacles.
Michelle, I want to get your reaction to that, focusing on class as opposed to race. Chief Justice Roberts, in one of his questions, asked, and you're in Michigan, I'm a Michigan native, so I understood this, are these policies meant to protect someone like, say, a wealthy Black applicant who lives in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, as opposed to somebody who has actually faced disadvantages? Would something like this possibly be an alternative in your view?
So, I mean, I want to say a couple of things. First, I want to thank Rick, and I want to agree with him that I think we're going to need, I agree with him in terms of my reading of where the court was yesterday, in terms of the direction we're going to go with race-based affirmative action. And so we're going to need a tremendous amount of creative and important thinking around how we are going to continue to maintain racial and economic diversity. And we need to have more economic diversity at selective institutions of higher education. So I think that that's incredibly important work, and I'm glad that it's being done. I think on the issue of sort of whether these will be true substitutes, I haven't looked as much at sort of the modeling that Rick is talking about. I will say, however, that Michigan in their brief seems to suggest that that wouldn't work here in the state of Michigan because there are so many more white folks at every sort of economic band such that it would be very difficult to substitute class for race and be able to generate the kind of diversity that would be enhancing the educational benefits of all. And so I think there's that. And then the final, I guess my final reaction is this, the word wealth, you know, we sort of talk about sort of like the children of Obama or the children of black doctors and black lawyers, but there is a significant difference in terms of wealth when we look even at the black middle and upper classes. There's not been tremendous wealth generation. There's income, but not wealth. And so mixing all of the folks in terms of legacies, because now, of course, we are at a place where we're just having sort of the first and maybe sort of the second generation of folks who benefited from affirmative action. Now their children are applying to these selective institutions. I think on average, those parents are not as wealthy as the other kinds of people who might benefit from legacy admissions.
I want to talk for a moment about the ripple effect when it comes to diversity beyond the classroom. And that's one thing that Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar focused on during oral arguments yesterday when she noted how diversity in civilian institutions benefit the diversity in the military.
It is critically important to the military to be able to achieve diverse student bodies in the service academies, but it's also critically important because actually more officers come from ROTC programs to try to protect and preserve space for universities to also achieve the educational benefits of diversity and provide the path to leadership that inherent in those programs as well.
And she noted that the Pentagon sees that not just as an admirable policy, but a national security issue to make sure that the military has diversity within its ranks. Rick, talk a little bit about that. Do you think that these alternatives to trying to ensure diversity can protect not just within the classroom, but beyond when it comes to other things like the military who say they need diversity in schools in order to ensure diversity is within their ranks?
Yes, and to be clear, I agree with that assessment. I think the military and all of our institutions need racial and economic diversity in order to succeed. One of the things I want to pick up on that Michelle said I think is very important has to do with how we go about defining socioeconomic obstacles, because she's absolutely right that there is there's an income gap in this country between black people and white people. There's a much, much larger wealth gap between the black and white communities and also Latino communities. And so an admissions officer should look not just at the income of applicant's family, but also the wealth. And when you do that, you help to implicitly recognize our nation's history of slavery and segregation and redlining and housing discrimination, because wealth captures more elegantly the ways in which our history impacts the economic status of people today, and it's a fair thing to do on its own right. I mean, coming from a low wealth family presents an obstacle, and so I think in the future that's where the institutions of the military and institutions of higher education can really have an impact on doing better than, for example, the University of Michigan has so far in using socioeconomic preferences to produce racial diversity.
Justice Elena Kagan posed a series of questions yesterday about whether considering race would be inappropriate in different professional settings.
If you're a hospital and you serve a diverse group of patients, is it super important to you to have a diverse set of doctors?
I don't know that the evidence about the diversity of doctors and patients or anything about the medical field.
It wouldn't matter. Yeah. Okay. Or maybe it would. You don't know. If you're a police department and you serve a diverse community, is it super important to you to have a diverse set of police officers?
I mean, I believe that's important if there's good evidence that a racial classification was needed. That has nothing to do with the educational benefits of diversity in universities. That's the interest that Grutter upheld.
Do you think that if you're a law firm or if you're a judge and you want to have a diverse set of clerks, do you think a judge can't think about that in making clerkship decisions?
So, Michelle, one thing that I thought about in listening to the arguments is if the court rules that race can't be considered in public universities or those that receive public funding, hospitals, police departments, courts, those are all public sector or places that receive public funding. Could employment decisions in those contexts be next?
Well, I think certainly if those employers are using race overtly in making the determination around who's going to be hired, that's certainly at issue, right? We've got another statute that becomes relevant, not just Title VI, but also Title VII, which prohibits race discrimination in employment. But I think the larger question is, and this was a big point across the arguments, is what do we do about proxies, right? What do we do when we move to the next level? And let's say that the decision maker, whether it's a hospital or a police officers, or a university wants to seek to achieve race diversity, but they're going to use a race-neutral means to do it. And certainly the thought had been that that would be perfectly constitutional. And one of the things that was unsettling about the oral argument yesterday is that I thought I heard some at least set up for the idea that, listen, if you use a proxy, but the rationale behind the proxy is an attempt to achieve racial diversity. Well, gee, that's a racial classification scheme too, and that should be equally unconstitutional. And that, I think, is very, very troubling. There's another set of doctrine that controls that. But I didn't hear the challenger say, no, that's all good. I really didn't. And in fact, there was a back and forth around sort of giving a benefit to the ancestors, folks whose ancestors had been slaves, and there was some concern about that.
Well, I just want to give the last 30 seconds to Rick that if these alternatives don't work, should then race be considered at least as one as many factors if it's shown that the alternatives don't get the same effect?
Well, that's the position I took in my testimony in the case, that race-neutral alternatives should be employed because they're fair, less divisive, for a whole variety of reasons. But at the end of the day, if they did not produce racial diversity, then I personally would leave the door open for using race. I think in most cases it won't be necessary, but it should be available as a last resort.
Rick Kallenberg, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Kimberly.
And Michelle Adams, thank you for being on Point.
My pleasure.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.